episode 53 of the Flagstick.com Tee Talk podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott McLeod, the editorial director of Flagstick Golf Magazine and a PGA professional. Doing a solo show this week. Unfortunately, my co-host, Stefan Tiedorf, is away. He's down in Mexico enjoying himself, having some nice relaxing time with his lovely wife before the golf season gets started. Everything gets really, really busy. So we're going to make this a quick one today. I've got a few things to discuss. First thing, just want to thank everybody for listening. Got a lot of feedback in the last little while. Been very, very happy to hear that. Great to hear feedback on the show. Looking forward to a lot of shows coming up. We've got some great guests coming up. We're also going to introduce some sponsors as well to the show. Had some great feedback from the golf community and from the corporate community as well. So we're looking forward to introducing you to them. And we've got a great guest this week. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Craig Lochrie is going to join us from Golf Ontario. For those who have been worried about the World Handicap System, wondering how it works, how it is going to affect your handicap, your index, Craig is definitely going to be the guy to help explain that. He spent many years on the World Handicap System Committee, the committee that led up to creating the system. But he certainly addresses a lot of questions in the interview. We really appreciate him coming on. The other thing as well, Craig is also the tournament director for the Ontario Open. For those not familiar, the tournament came back last year after a multi-year absence. It celebrated the 93rd anniversary. It had been 93 years since it had first been played, and it came back last year at Woodington Lake, just north of Toronto, and also had the Ontario Disability Championship as part of that as well. So it was quite an event, and they had big news to share this year. We shared that on the podcast earlier this year, the fact that they are now part of the Mackenzie Tour, the PGA Tour affiliated and owned tour. And as a result, they expect big changes for the event. And he'll touch on that briefly. We'll probably have him come back to give us more details on that going forward. But certainly it's big news for that event to now be an official part of the Mackenzie Tour, which is now a 13-event circuit for this year, including that Golf Ontario Open. So really looking forward to hearing more about that. So I think you'll enjoy that guest, and certainly I think it will provoke some questions as well about the World Handicap System. And if you do have some, please feel free to pass them on to us. If you check our show notes on Fireside, you'll also see a link to Craig's social media. If you want to reach him, just reach out to us on Flagstick. At Flagstick on Twitter is probably the easiest way to do it, or at Flagstick Golf on Instagram. Okay, a little recap this week. Certainly a lot of events went on. Some significant ones from a Canadian standpoint, others not so much, but definitely from a world standpoint. Things we definitely want to at least touch on before we head into our feature interview. So first off, Adam Scott returned to the winner's circle. It was his first win since the 2016 WGC Mexico Championship. He won at Riviera. A lot of players in the mix late there. And some people were wondering if Adam Scott was going to fail, especially from the putter side of it. And he certainly sank some crucial putts on the way in. The neat part for him is he now heads back to the Mexico Championship, where he's actually won in 2016, as I mentioned. He won that championship. He's won twice at World Championship events, and this is his first appearance in Mexico at that event since 2017, where he tied for 45th. Down on the Korn Ferry Tour, four Canadians finished in the top 26 as the tour returned to Florida. It actually had been playing in Panama and Colombia. If you listened to our interview last week with Taylor Pendrith, obviously they had their swing down there in Central America and South America, but they returned for the Lecom Health Classic on the west coast of Florida. And the four Canadians that finished in that top 26 there, Ben Silverman was tops at T11, Adam Svensson and Taylor Pender at T26, and the one that surprised the most, who was at T2 at one point in the final round, was Mike Weir. Now, Mike Weir finished T17, the iconic Canadian, eight-time winner on the tour, obviously a Masters champion. He turns 50 coming this May 12th. He'll be eligible for the Senior PGA just 9 days later as a past Masters champion, but he's getting his game ready. And he had quite the final round. It was pretty impressive, and it included an albatross on the front nine. It certainly had me wondering if it actually was a two or not. If you're not paying attention to this stuff sometimes, if you're looking at live scoring, sometimes it's not always accurate. It's hard to get excited in real time on things like Twitter, just in case that it's not right, especially when you see things like holding ones on par fours or albatrosses, unusual scoring runs. But in fact, Mike had made two, and his quote about it was, "I hit a nice drive. I think I had 230 yards. It was a hybrid four iron. I hit a nice shot and just kind of rolled in like a putt. It was exciting." So pretty amazing. I mean, he was playing really well there, especially on that front nine. He went 7 under for that early stretch and said he was hitting the ball really well. He was near all the par fives, getting the ball close from there. And the funny part is he actually mentioned that he didn't feel that he was making a lot of putts. So obviously his game is getting sharp. He's getting closer. He wants to be competitive, he said, on the Champions Tour. And so far, just his play of late really indicates that, you know, he is getting ready and he is prepared. So it's been 28 or 29 years since he had made an albatross. He had one other one. He said it was a hole-in-one on a par four. He made it when he was in college. It was not during an event. He played college golf at BYU. And it's nice to see Mike playing well. Another Canadian playing well over on the PGA Champions Tour was Stephen Ames. Stephen Ames is finished tied for ninth at the Chubb Classic. Now, he's had two starts so far this year on the PGA Champions Tour, a second in Morocco and this T9. So a second top 10 start to the season. Obviously swinging well, has a lot of confidence. So certainly I would not be surprised to see him pick up a win on that tour at some point. For you late night owls catching the golf coming in from Australia, I don't know about you, I love this time of year where we can catch all this golf coming in from Australia. We get to see some of these fine golf courses, obviously some great play. We've talked about it on the podcast a bit, whether it's the Vic Open or one of the other championships that's being played. But the Women's Australian Open was being played in NB Park, won her 20th LPGA title down there. That's her first title in 2 years. The seven-time major champion put on quite a show at Royal Adelaide. And Royal Adelaide itself was quite spectacular. Tremendous golf course, a lot of shot requirements for the players. It was playing firm, so the ball was kind of bounding all over the place, and it was just a fun, entertaining event to watch. Unfortunately, Alina Sharp was the only Canadian in the field, and she did miss the cut. And unfortunately as well, it's going to be a while before we see LPGA action again. It'll be the Volvic Founders Cup at the end of March. Unfortunately, a number of the LPGA Tour events on the Asian Swing were canceled due to the coronavirus. So we'll have to wait on LPGA action for quite some time, including our own Canadian Brooke Henderson, who will be out of play until then. In the meantime, if you want to keep track of the LET, the Ladies European Tour, they're playing down in Australia this week. And I know we've got four Canadians playing down there, Robin Doig, Anna Young, Megan Osland, Hannah Hellyer, and they're all in the field this week. So if you want to keep an eye on that, I'm sure they'll have some decent results online. I don't know if there's any TV coverage for that, but you might be able to find something streaming. But something, if you want to watch some women's golf, definitely it is out there. One other Canadian win of note this week, Aaron Crawford of Calgary, who, if some of you are not familiar, he was a very early guest on the Tee Talk podcast, going all the way back to episode 4. This is a guy who split his time between caddying and playing. Great story. Definitely want to go back and listen to that one. He went 20 under par to win on the Outlaw Tour, which is a mini tour out in Arizona, but a nice win for him and good to see. And there was a couple other Canadians in the top 5 as well. But certainly go back and check out his episode and hear his story. You'll hear about him more in the future. All right, there's a few other things I probably want to get to, but, you know, it's really difficult to do solo. The things I probably want to discuss a little bit more with Stefan back in the studio next week. So we'll leave it for then. Some thoughts on the Premier Golf League, Rory stepping out of that. One last thing before we head into the interview with Craig Lochry of Golf Ontario. The Flagstick Open Amateur Championship presented by TaylorMade and Adidas. The registration is now open. So if you want to go to flagstickopen.com, you can check that out for just over a couple hundred dollars. You can get 2 rounds at the lovely Equinel Golf Club in Kempville, Ontario. This has been a multi-year event for us and certainly has produced some great winners. We've had a 2-time winner in Noah Steele, who's now on Team Canada. Lots of other collegiate players, top amateurs come and play this event. But you'll note that this year we've added another division as well to sort of spread the love out. We have a D flight as well, just to make it a little bit easier. We have a head previously ABC, and now we added a D just to bring in some higher handicappers and give them an opportunity to play in the event and also feel that they have an opportunity to win it as well. Basically, what we've done is formerly the C flight was a little wide, and we wanted to make sure that we tighten that up a little bit to give the higher handicappers a chance to get to the prize table. But great swag for this event. We're still working on it with the sponsors, but we'll certainly announce that soon. And if you're interested in signing up and coming out to that event, which will be held on the May long weekend on the Saturday, Sunday, flagstickopen.com is where you head. Let's get to the interview now. Craig Lockery was so gracious to join us from Golf Ontario to talk to us about the World Handicap System and a little bit about the Ontario Open as well. I think you'll enjoy the interview. And as I mentioned, if you've got some questions for him about the World Handicap System or the Ontario Open, please pass them on, but enjoy the interview. Okay, we'd like to welcome in a very special guest. We've been talking a lot on this show. We talked about the new World Handicap System that was coming into play for 2020. And you know what? We've got an expert here from Golf Ontario with us, somebody who is highly involved in the process of creating this system. Craig Lockery was on the World Handicap Committee for the past 5 years. Since its inception, the committee is made up of handicapping experts from around the world, from the RNA, USGA, Japan, Australia, Argentina, Portugal, Sweden, South Africa, and of course Canada. He wears many hats for Golf Ontario, and we'll get to that as well, as the director for the Ontario Open, which obviously had some big news lately. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Stefan.
So first off, a lot of people are worried about the World Handicap System. They're worried about how it's going to change their handicap. What are the key things about the new system that have changed?
Yeah, so I would say the primary four things that I would like to talk about that I think are noticeable change from our previous system is, one, that the formula itself has changed. I know that might sound a little scary, but we'll talk about some of the technical changes that happen with the formula. There's also some new mechanisms that were put into play, the what we call the cap mechanism. And then there's this other tool that's buried within the system called the PCC, which is the playing conditions calculation. I think that's something that your listeners would want to hear
about.
Yeah,
definitely.
And the final thing would be the old equitable stroke control was, that's now called maximum hole score, which is net double bogey. That's a new term, and I'm sure we'll get to that in a few minutes too.
So really, when someone's, you know, establishing a handicap in the first place, they're trying to get a handicap index, there were certain parameters that existed before as far as maximum handicap, how many scores they had to have. What's the new conditions that exist, and, you know, how are they a little bit more friendly towards the emerging golfer?
Right. So when the committee was formulated, we sort of gave ourselves some guiding principles. One was to try and make the system as simple as possible, also to make it as relevant as possible to as many golfers, you know, to kind of be, you know, inclusive. And so with that, one of the main parameters of the former system was you needed a minimum of 5 scores to even establish a handicap index. So you'd need 5 18-hole scores. And you know, now we've sort of made that easier. It's only 3 18-hole scores or any combination of 9 and 18-hole scores to produce that initial handicap index. So that made it a little bit easier. And along with that change, we also raised the maximum handicap index that you could receive, whereas before it was 40.4 for women, 36.4 for men. We raised that to 54.0 for both men and women at whatever the word I'm looking for both genders.
What was the reasoning for that? 50, like 54. I mean, can you imagine being a scratch golfer? You're playing in a match play. Like, all right, you get 8 on this hole.
Yeah. And that's conceivable. So what we did was we relied on some really smart people. They're part of our handicap research team. And so these are individuals that used to work for NASA. One gentleman actually designed the U.S. Navy's navigational system. These are the experts in statistical analysis. And so what we asked them was, what would be the upper and lower limits that we could go to feel comfortable about, you know, creating an equitable match? And they were comfortable with a minimum of 3 scores and raising it to 54.0. That those were the limits. If you go beyond that, everybody's probably, you don't have to be a statistical major to understand a bell curve, right? You've got what we think will happen for the majority, and there's always going to be some outliers. But that bell curve helps us work within that that frame or that scale that we've set. So I agree with you. On paper or optically, it probably looks like, oh my God, you know, having to give a golfer 8 shots on one particular hole, that probably looks, you know, a little overwhelming. However, it is equitable. And I would say the second thing is there probably aren't too many golfers that have a handicap index that high that would be looking to compete right off the bat. That they probably just don't feel comfortable competing in a competition at that point. They're probably going to want to get themselves, you know, into a partnered event or something like that, yes. But on an individual basis, not that likely.
I guess one of the biggest takeaways from that is that despite what people think on Twitter, you didn't actually just grab Bob and Jimmy from the 19th hole and say, you know, let's come up with a handicap system and an afternoon on the back of a napkin, right? I mean, how involved was this process? I mean, I mentioned 5 years off the top, but I mean, was that 5 years of like intensive meetings and a lot of alterations? And obviously, as you said, you've got a lot of smart people involved. I mean, how deep was this?
It was, we looked on the hood, under the hood of everything. So what we did, you know, the very first meeting was kind of a discovery meeting. That was actually in London, England. And what we did there was we said, you know, went around the horn, went around the table. There's 23 of us on the committee from all parts of the world. And we said, look, let's be honest. What are the things that we like about our own current handicap systems across the world? We'll put all those in one basket. What are the things that we don't like or that we think we could improve on our own systems? We'll put that in another basket. We'll see where we are, you know, where the common ground is that, you know, there isn't going to be a lot of arguments or discussion about. And that was our starting point. And then we just kind of, you know, as you said, 5 years just kind of knocked out each section, you know, on its own. Now, with that, I will add that Canada had some of the cleanest hole-by-hole data by which to supply the handicap research team to do a lot of the statistical analysis. So we had, that was kind of our give to the system, was we had about 10 million hole-by-hole scores that they could run simulations on to see how statistically relevant or accurate some of the things that we were contemplating on putting into the system would work or not work.
So can you just quick favor and just kind of explain, you know, as simple as possible, you know, this cap mechanism, like what exactly does that mean?
Yeah. So I would say loosely, this is going to be referred to, and we were throwing this around the committee, is it's a cap on a cap. And so there are two parts to this. There's a soft cap and a hard cap. And I think the hard cap's probably the easiest to explain. A hard cap would be that ceiling. We're not going to allow you to go up from that point forward. And how it works is we calculate a low handicap index for each player in the system. And the low handicap index is basically, you know, the formula itself, so taking your low weight of your most recent 20 in the last 365 days. So whatever you've achieved as your lowest handicap index over that period of time, we're going to kind of anchor you there. And what we won't do is the hard cap hits is we won't allow you to go up more than five strokes more than that. So if you were a 12 handicap, for example, and you had a string of bad scores or high scores that was projecting you your handicap index to be calculated up north of or higher than 17 if it were to go to try and go to 20, we wouldn't allow that to happen. The hard cap would hit and it would maximize you at 17.
I like that. So like, so the idea really is you know, avoid the old sandbaggers in a sense, right? Like you see those guys that enter things, you know, those certain tournaments where they really, you know, they try to force their cap up in, you know, terrible ways. And these people are the worst already, but it's to hopefully stop these things. Is that what I'm getting at?
That is true. And, you know, there may be other reasons for that happening. You know, maybe the player was injured or, you know, broken arm, whatever health issue that they might have. And that might be a valid reason to allow the handicap index to go north of that, you know, hard cap. And that's okay because a handicap committee at the club can actually make that call. But on the other hand, there was a real consensus around, you know, this is from research that we conducted amongst golfers and clubs, you know, that wanted some safety nets built into the system, you know, some trigger points that would help the committees do their job, but also help maintain that equity. So if there was a valid reason for somebody to go north of the hard cap, the handicap committee can actually make that call and override the cap mechanism.
Nice. Now, one thing that's been really interesting for me is this new playing conditions calculation. It's something a number of my friends have discussed. And, you know, obviously there's an adjustment available based on the conditions that are happening when you're playing in that particular day. But again, this has caused some people to go, well, how's that work? And, you know, how do we calculate that based on just our group?
This is really going to hurt my vanity cap.
Yeah. But
It might help my vanity
cap. Because obviously we know, you know, conditions play a factor as far as golf is concerned and you know, how hard a golf course is that particular day. And this system has actually worked something in.
Yeah, you're right. So this was something that we felt over here in North America that was one of the things that was missing from our system. You know, if Scott were to go out, you know, on, you know, in the morning and play his round really quickly, he might, you know, enjoy, you know, a good string of weather. And everybody that plays in the afternoon, a storm blows in, you know, you got 40 kilometer an hour winds, you know, rain, some, you know, real difficult conditions. And we wondered, you know, how could we account for that in the system? And there were a few other handicap systems that were doing this down, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and European Golf Association. And even in Scotland, they would change their course rating for the day depending on, you know, the wind direction even and how strong it was. So there were accommodations for this in other systems, but this wasn't something that we had in ours. And so what we did was, we put the best of the best together. We also ran some statistical analysis, and what we came up with this PCC is actually, it's new to even the other bodies. They said, look, there's some problems with what we've, you know, designed. It doesn't work perfectly. It works pretty good. It works better than nothing. And that's where we ended up with a PCC. And so how that works is we're going to take the scores for the day and we're going to analyze them. And we know what to expect. So, for example, when people play, we know that they're going to play two or beat their handicap 20% of the time. So let's say we just built in a small buffer. Let's call it 5% of either side of that. If results show us at the end of the day that everybody, you know, on average, play two within that threshold, then there'll be no adjustment. However, if nobody in the field for that day played two or beat their handicap, we know something happened. We don't know if that was adverse weather conditions. We don't know if the golf course was set up really difficult with really tough hole locations, or maybe the tees were pushed back and it played much more difficult than the course and slope rating had been provided. But the data is going to tell us that. So this is really all data driven. And how that works, to Scott's question, was when the scores are posted, we're going to analyze them overnight, and the next morning, if there's an adjustment that's needed, we'll apply that to the score differential.
It's pretty cool. I thought when I first saw this, I thought maybe you're pushing a button on your, you know, your Golf Canada app or whatever it is that says, you know, unusual conditions or something along those lines. Like,
It was really hard today.
Yeah. Today I had a hard time. That's interesting that it's more of a, you know, a data science behind it more than anything.
It is. I would say the number one question that we've gotten on this is, you know, how are you guys going to program weather into this? And, it's really just going to be organic through the data. You know, we really won't know exactly if it was adverse weather conditions, and we won't really know if it was the course setup, if it was set up very difficult or very easy. Maybe the golf course, you know, is doing some construction on some tees and they need to push the tees forward a couple hundred yards. And that will come out in the data, we would expect.
How much of an adjustment can be made then? I mean, is it endless or is there a limit to it?
To the cap mechanism, to the PCC.
PCC, yep.
So on the easy side, we'll let it go to a +1 adjustment. So really, we're going to work in whole strokes.
Okay.
And the scale will also slide. If it plays a little more difficult, we'll go to -2, -1, or -3. And that's the maximum that we would, adjust any score differential.
Interesting. So how does that affect it? Obviously, if we have a setup, for an example, for our tournament, is it the same thing? I mean, you know, they get the calculation the next day after it's adjusted, or, you know, do we have a course handicap prior?
Yeah, so your course handicap will be supplied for that particular day.
Okay.
And it's really up to the after the analysis is run and applied and it might affect somebody's handicap index, it's really up to the handicap committee if they want to use the new handicap index to crunch a new course handicap for a multi-day event. Our recommendation would be at the start of the competition, whether it's a 2 or 3 or 4 day event, is just use the handicap index or the course handicap that's calculated on the first day. You don't have to go back and keep recalculating. Yeah.
Gotcha.
I think one of the biggest changes on this is the new maximum hole score. So in the past, it was called, your equitable stroke control. I could try to give a breakdown of the change, but turns out I checked my LinkedIn. I never worked for NASA. So why don't you give us a quick breakdown? Let's talk about the old system and then, what the new system actually means.
Yeah, so the old equitable stroke control, everybody might remember, was chart-based and it was flat. So in other words, if you were a 9 or less, you actually would count double bogey. If you were 10 to a 19, you counted a 7. And it really didn't matter what the par of the actual hole was. And then the next increments would be 20 to 29, where you would count a maximum of 8, and then 30 to 39, a maximum of 9, and then anybody that was 40 and over would count a maximum of 10. So that's how the old system worked. The new system, as I mentioned earlier, is called net double bogey. And so that might twist a few people's shorts, but this came from other parts of the world where they've been using this for over 30 years. And so what net double bogey is it's, it's unique to each individual. So it's par plus any handicap strokes that you would be entitled to. So you're going to have to know what the stroke hole is. And then you add another 2 for the double bogey component of it.
So yeah, if it's a par 5, it's the hardest handicap on the course. You're, a 9 handicap per se. You're getting a stroke on that hole. You're looking at an 8 as the net double bogey. You go out there, you blast 6 off the tee. Well, you got your 8 and you walk away, right?
That's right. And for I was just going to add that for any of your listeners, if they don't quite, grasp that concept, we've been recommending at Golf Ontario, and we've got the steam behind, we've got about 20 to 30 golf clubs that are actually going to make the switch. If you just want to post your score hole by hole, the system, the Golf Canada Score Center, will actually adjust your scores for you automatically. So if you're worried about not understanding what net double bogey is, that tool will actually make sure that your scores go in properly for handicap purposes, but you can also see where the adjustments are being made. So I think you could actually use it as a learning tool for your first few scores so that you understand what net double bogey actually is.
How do you think this overall change plays to, the average player's experience in the game of golf across the board?
Yeah, I think net double bogey seems to be one of the ones that's, a hard concept to grasp just based off of, we've been using our equitable stroke control for about the last 16 years or so. It was something that we switched here in Canada to when the USGA, I think it was about 30 years ago, switched to a new version of their ESC. And what we did here in Canada was we actually just didn't switch. We told them, no, at that time, we're comfortable with our current version of equitable stroke control. So I would say for Canada, you know, this will be the second switch in about 16 years, whereas I think the U.S. is, you know, has that chart memorized as a, you know, an average golfer who's been using it for 30, 40 years, you know, so, and change sometimes is a little bit hard to digest, especially in golf, as you know, a pretty traditional game. And sometimes change isn't embraced too well, or sometimes not fast enough, especially in this day and age when, you know, we're in a kind of a now and me society. So I think this one will be an interesting topic to follow over the next few months, especially when we open our doors in April to some golf and people start posting their scores and seeing that we've got a real change here.
So how have the association's been dealing with the education process? I mean, obviously, as you said, it's going to take a while for people to get used to something new because they've been doing the same thing for so long. But there's a piece in there, obviously, that the associations have to do a little bit of work from a customer service standpoint. But what have you guys been doing, and what are the plans going forward to help people out?
Yeah, that's certainly our role in partnership with Golf Canada, is to educate the golfing public and all the clubs and facilities on these changes. So, you know, we've done a few things. One, we've armed all of the clubs, you know, just over a month ago with a pre-canned club educational package. So they can actually just grab some of the infographics and some of the, you know, the new tools and new changes. And they can just simply send them out, like basically copy and paste into their newsletters plus their social channels. We've actually been doing that ourselves at Golf Ontario, and so is Golf Canada. And we've also been putting on some in-person World Handicap Seminar educational seminars. We did one in Ottawa, actually at Ottawa Hunt there back in October. And we've been going across the province. I think we've done about eight this past fall. We've got another slate scheduled for this spring. We've got another seven or eight, and we've also got club educational sessions. So we've got about 80 golf clubs that have signed up for a one night seminar. Those are free. All you have to do is sign up, and, you know, we'll come out. We've got a pre-canned presentation that takes about 30 minutes to go through, and we allow for a 20 to a 30 minute question and answer so that it's interactive and everybody gets the answers that they need.
So if people want to find out where they can go to those and where the list of the sites are, where do they find that online, I suppose?
Yeah, if they want to come to our website at gao.ca, just go into the handicap section, and we've got a handicap resource center in there. We've got all of the seminars already outlined. There's also a couple of webinars, and you can just sign up for those right there at the handicap resource site, right at gao.ca.
All right. Well, let's get your other hat on now as the tournament director for the Ontario Open. For those not familiar with the Ontario Open, we've talked about it a fair bit on this podcast. Obviously, it was revived last year in a different format, a historic event in Ontario. But a recent announcement down at the PGA Merchandise Show has sort of changed the level of the tournament more than anything. And we talked a little bit down there. It is now going to be part of the Mackenzie Tour event. And as I mentioned, you're going to have to wear the hat as the tournament director. So let's talk a little bit about that and what the big change is this year, and kind of what are the plans for this event.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very excited that we're going to be part of the Mackenzie Tour schedule, and happy to be partnering with the PGA Tour Canada, and you know, and of course our host and sponsor in Woodington Lake Golf Club. There's a new ownership group there. They're shaking things up in terms of you know, traditional golf entertainment and recreation. They've got a lot of really great ideas, and not to totally sell you on it, but one of them has a restaurant background and totally changed the food menu at the club, and it's dynamite there.
So, you know, what are people expecting that are going to be different? I mean, this is a Mackenzie Tour event. I did talk to, you know, one of the owners down at the show, and they have hinted at some different things that they're going to do that are going to be exciting. I haven't got all those details yet. Is there anything that you can share at this point?
Yeah, we've had a lot of exciting meetings, but I don't want to disappoint you, but we don't have anything firm, but we sure do have grand plans. I will tease you with this, that I think our tour stop will not be anything like any of the other tour stops. So if that's not a tease, I don't know what would be. I would say we're going to have something between, a rock solid, great golf championship, and maybe something more along the lines of the Waste Management. Does that kind of give you a good tease?
Sure. A lot of entertainment value is what it sounds like. Now, one of the things that happened as a result of this announcement, it was announced that it was a 6-year deal. And how does that play mm-hmm. into the part for planning for this event, of having the security of a long-term sponsor like that, and knowing that you can go into that and plan for the long-term and not just the short-term?
Yeah, that was, a big selling point for us, you know, with that commitment from the ownership group. It obviously gives us time to build towards, you know, so obviously, you know, year one will look probably a lot different than year six. As we, build out the event, it does take time in some markets to build these types of events that come around once a year. So I would say, you're right. The commitment, the 6-year commitment, was a big selling point for us, because when we restarted the Ontario Open and the board of directors gave, you know, the staff the green light to go look for this, you know, a partner to restart the Open, it wasn't a short-term vision. We want the championship to go for the next 100 years straight. We don't want it to stop like it did in 1997.
So for those not familiar with Woodington Lake, obviously it's a, you know, let's say it, a, we'll call it a premium public facility. Is that how you would describe it?
It is how I would describe it. So it's a 36-hole facility. You have a legacy course and a legends course. Both courses are over 7,000 yards, good test of golf. I would say one golf course is a little more walkable than the other, but really a different style of golf course. There's the Legends course has more of a waste bunker feel to it, and the Legacy course is more the traditional Parkland style course through, you know, trees and various other obstacles that you have to overcome.
Now, both courses being used for the championship, or is it just the one?
So we're using both courses. We're using one course, the Legends course, for the Ontario Disabilities Championship, using the Legacy course for the Ontario Open.
All right. That was actually going to be one of my next questions, was how does the Ontario Disability Championship, which was obviously a new event that was debuted last year, quite successful, and your champion there has had further success, and Curtis Barkley is, we've talked about Curtis on the show and his success down in Australia, but, how is that going to play a role during that week?
Yeah, so we still plan, that was a huge feature for us, was to, on the front end of that, celebrate the Ontario Open with the launch of the Ontario Disabilities Championship. And so that will still be the case. So the dates will be on the front end. So on the Monday, August 24th, I believe, is the final day of the Ontario Disabilities Championship. So they'll be finishing up on the Monday of the, practice round of the Ontario Open, or the start of our week.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for coming on the show. Obviously, you've got to wear a lot of hats, as we mentioned, but lots of great information, and we look forward to hearing more updates from you. It sounds like you're probably not going to have a lot of time for your own golf game. For people that don't know, Craig's a fairly accomplished golfer as well, won a few Ontario Public Player Championships, but maybe that handicap of your own will be rising in the next little while. But we want to thank you for coming on the show and sort of, you know, explaining the World Handicap System, because obviously a lot of people have a lot of questions about it, and we certainly appreciate your feedback on it.
Well, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to help explain it to your listeners, and don't hesitate to call or reach out if you have any more questions. Would love to come back on the show when you have the chance.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for that interview, Craig. Really appreciate that. Answered a lot of questions for us on the World Handicap System, things that we've been thinking about, other things we had not been thinking about as well. If the listeners have any questions, please pass them on to us, and we'll pass them on to Craig as well and see if we can get those answered for you. But certainly we appreciate his time and his insight on that and the Ontario Open as well. All right, let's get to the week ahead here. Obviously, as this podcast comes out, PGA Tour play is underway, both in Mexico and Puerto Rico. The LPGA does not restart again until the Volvic Founders Cup in Arizona, unfortunately. So, men's golf it is, and the key event this week is going to be the World Golf Championship in Mexico. Canadian Corey Connors is in the field, as well as 42 of the top 50 players from the official World Golf Rankings. Dustin Johnson will be going for his third win in the fourth start at this event site. He's the defending champion. He captured his 20th PGA Tour title here last year. He's looking to be the first to successfully defend his title since Tiger Woods won it 2005 or 2007 when it was being played in South Florida. Another significant player this week, obviously number one, Rory McIlroy, number one in the world. He was a runner-up last year in Mexico, and now he's heading for the WGC Slam. He needs this last event to have captured all of the World Golf Championships. And I think, I don't know if that's that important to him, but, you know, another notch in his belt for the number one player in the world. Over in Puerto Rico, we've got four Canadians playing. Roger Sloan, David Hearn, Michael Gligic, and Derek Gillespie is in the field. For those not familiar with Derek Gillespie, you know, this guy is a consummate journeyman. I've seen Derek play a fair bit over the years. Derek is 41 now, from Oshawa, Ontario, originally. He's making just his 11th PGA start. He's doing it based on winning a qualifier in Florida in January. He shot 10 under for three rounds. This guy has continually just kept at it. Everybody's always wondered when he's going to have his big break. Who knows? He might be in Puerto Rico this week. Martin Trainer is the defending champion there. Martin, as many of you are familiar, has been a two-time guest on this podcast. He actually had a really bright spot last week, made his first cut in, I think, 21 starts, something like that, last week at Riviera. So that's a good sign as he heads into Puerto Rico, and we wish him well there. All right, last thing we'll get to is the mailbag. A little quick tip, and we'll get out of here. Like I said, just going to be a quick episode this week with Stefan away. Nobody really debate things back and forth with, but we certainly will return birdie versus bogey and a few other elements next week with Stefan back, and have a little bit of discussion about some different topics. And certainly, we appreciate your feedback as well. As I mentioned off the top, we love the feedback we've been getting. So please, you know, chime in for the mailbag. Please leave us a review if you can. It's very helpful for supporting the podcast. You can do that over on Apple Podcasts. We're also available on Spotify as well, and you can catch it at flagstick.com, and you'll see that it also generates out to some other outlets as well. But if you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, we'd certainly appreciate it. And also, you know, you can leave some questions there too, and if you have some other questions, certainly pass them on through our Twitter feed at flagstick, or Instagram at flagstickgolf. Our DMs are always open. All right, let's get to the mailbag this week. Just four questions tucked into the mailbag. Had a few more, but going to save those for next week with Stefan. And we'll get started here with, my putter grip is warm, but I'm afraid if I change it, I won't putt as well. What should I do? Well, change it. That's all I got to say. You know what? The thing about putter grips is they wear out just like anything else. It is your only contact point with your putter. And just because you're putting well with it, obviously make sure that, you know, with the new installation that it's aligned properly, you get a shape that you like as far as it fits your hand, fits your putting style, but certainly don't shy away from making a change. I see a lot of players wearing, you know, using worn putter grips out there. It just eliminates your ability to control the club and control the stroke as well. And obviously it's our only contact point. So yeah, change it up. Don't worry about it. If you don't start putting well, it probably has to do with something else, but just leaving on there as a lucky charm is probably not going to do you well, and I'm sure all the club makers out there would agree with me as well. Interesting second question here. Are we overthinking every aspect of golf, especially on social media? Well, this is an interesting topic, and it's something I might bring up with Stefan. I think we want to explore this a little bit more in the next little while, but I'll just give a quick sort of take on it. I think what you're going to find on social media is the people that are very passionate about golf, the people that want to be talking about golf. Obviously, we have platforms like social media to discuss every aspect of the game, whether it's minutia that, you know, not everyone cares about it. So yes, I would say some people are probably overthinking about it, but again, you know, it's their hobby, it's their passion, it's what they want to talk about. So nobody's going to be able to prevent that. If you don't want to be part of those discussions, you know, just turn off notifications, step away from it. Might be healthier for you. But I think that merits a lot of discussion about, you know, is that discussion on there, you know, relatable to more the smaller portion of the people that are actually playing the game? And I think we can look forward to maybe some further discussions on that when Stefan returns. Two more questions here, and we'll head on to the tip and get out of here. We're looking for a destination for a spring golf trip. Any spots I should consider? Well, there's a lot of places that you can play. Obviously, I assume this reader is from our neck of the woods in Canada, so they're going to need to at least get some place where they can get a little bit warmer as we head into, say, March, for an example. Now, you can do that within Canada. People sometimes forget, you know, you can head out to the West Coast. Lots of golf going on there. Things are drying up out there now. I've just talked to a good friend out in Vancouver yesterday, and you know, Vancouver area, Vancouver Island, mild weather, lots of great golf courses to play out there. So that's something you might want to consider if you want to stick with the Canadian dollar and in-country transportation. As far as other destinations that you can go to, tons that you can go to. I know a lot of people that head down to Penn National down in Pennsylvania. Great layout, layouts that open very early, put on some good packages in the spring. And for those in Eastern Ontario or in Ontario, not a long trip to get down there. Ocean City, Maryland, another popular one as well. Obviously, Myrtle Beach, definitely along that East Coast. You have to get a little further south if you want to get warmer. But seeing a lot of people as well head into the Carolinas, as I mentioned, Myrtle Beach, but North Carolina as well. Seeing some action in Pinehurst already. A lot of people getting down there to play. So I would say you're going to have to probably, for March, you probably have to get down to Pennsylvania. New York State would be a little dicey at that point, but you know, there's a few locations there. And as I mentioned, Vancouver, Vancouver Island, stay in Canada if you want, and you can get some good golf in there. Last question here, and we'll move on. Why don't the pros play every week that they can? Well, here's the thing. You don't work 52 weeks a year. Maybe you do, but you also have to understand that these players are out traveling, which takes time. They also have outside lives outside of the tournament days. And tournament golf is not just about, you know, 5 hours of playing golf. They have a lot of other things to do. They have to practice. They have sponsor obligations. There's a lot of things that go into a week. And you've got to remember, these are 7 days on when they get there. Not only do they have the travel days, they got to take care of things like laundry. You know, they've got to get the rest, their training. And those are why they take off weeks as well. I mean, obviously, they have families that they want to see. They want to get away. They want to get some rest. Maybe they want to make some adjustments in their game. Maybe they're working with their coach on some things that they don't necessarily want to be doing. at the golf course during a tournament week. And on top of that as well, I mean, when we talked about sponsor obligations, some of those take a lot of weeks and time away. I mean, if a player has, you know, let's say they have 8 to 10 corporate sponsors, which would be, you know, more of a top level player, most of those contracts require that player to give up a certain number of days a year to that corporation. And basically what they have to do is they may have to do an outing, they may have to do a clinic, they may have to do a corporate speaking engagement. And if you sort of start to figure it out, I mean, if they have 10 sponsors and that sponsor gets, let's say, 5 days a year, that's 50 days out of the year that they have those obligations to go and do some things. Could be a commercial shoot, plus the travel to those as well. So that's why they can't play every week. And you know, nobody is, you know, more avid than maybe like a player like Sungjae Im. And last year, you know, he played 30 plus events, but, you know, there are only 52 weeks in the year, and they certainly have some other things going on in their life. And while we might like to see them out there every possible week, sometimes it comes down to the golf course. Maybe they have a golf course that they don't like. They don't like how they play it. There could be some other aspect of it away from the golf course that they don't like, as far as the city, the travel, the complications of going in there, maybe how they're treated there before. I mean, who knows? There's a lot of factors that go in there. Maybe they don't get along with the tournament director. It's hard to say. There's a lot of things that can happen there, but generally you'll never see a player play every week that they possibly can. Quick tip of the week here, and it's a little bit of a nod as well. Mickey Wright, the great LPGA legend, passed away this week at age 85. Incredible player, very admired golf swing, but not only the other players, but coaches, all sorts of people said, you know, she had one of the greatest swings of all time. You know, she did not play a long time on the LPGA Tour, but she picked up 82 wins, which is second all time to Kathy Whitworth. And I think a lot of people can learn a lot from the freedom of her motion. So she did a lot of great things biomechanically, but she didn't really think about it. I mean, obviously we didn't have the measurement tools then that we did now as far as when she was playing, but you know, you got to work within what your body gives you. Don't be afraid to actually make a move. I think one of the things that happens for a lot of golfers is that, you know, they get afraid of hitting poor shots and they make their golf swing smaller and smaller and smaller. Next thing you know, they're just using a lot of their hands and arms, not using the overall aspect of their body. But you can't be afraid to make a move. Speed's a big factor in making a golf ball fly. And if you get a really restricted motion, just using a lot of your hands and arms, you don't create a lot of speed. So what I'm suggesting to you is go watch some of the swings on YouTube of Mickey Wright. Talk to your coach about the things that she did well that help her win those 82 times on the LPGA Tour. And I think you can add some things to your golf swing as well to have a little bit more freedom of movement in your golf swing to make it a lot better this year. So check out Mickey Wright videos. Learn what you can from that, and I think it will help your game. That wraps it up. Thanks, everyone. Like I said, shorter episode this week. I'm solo. A little hard to do by yourself. Don't have anyone to discuss things with, and Stefan is going to be back this week, so we're looking forward to that when he gets back from Mexico. I'm sure he might have a story or two from there. Enjoy the WC Mexico Championship, the Puerto Rico Open as well. Hopefully, you're going to get away and get some golf in soon. If not, some indoor work, maybe some training as well. Again, if you have any questions, please pass them on to us. Please leave a review if you can. We really appreciate any of the reviews. Five stars only if you can. Apple Podcasts, a great spot to leave that. Also on Spotify as well. And you can always catch the episodes at flagstick.com under podcast section. We have all our podcasts lined up there. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Some ocean, and a day like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.